This is Keller Henry for The Digital Divide. Black feminist scholar and activist Moya Bailey coined the term misogynoir in 2008 to discuss the specific discrimination Black women face every day. This discrimination comes in the form of stereotypes that have existed since the first Africans were enslaved and continues to impact Black women and gender-variant people at every level of social and economic class. Simply put, Black women face a double whammy of racism and misogyny that impacts them in nearly every facet of their lives. In the book Misogynoir Transformed, Black Women's Digital Resistance, Dr. Bailey focuses on Black women's use of digital media to promote social justice as acts of self-affirmation and health promotion, and how race, gender, and sexuality are represented in media and medicine. Dr. Moya Bailey, could you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Dr. Moya Bailey. I am currently an associate professor at Northwestern University in the School of Communication, and I have been thinking about this question of misogynoir for a very long time, back to when I was an undergraduate at Spelman College. But I didn't define misogynoir until I was working on my dissertation at Emory University. And in 2008, I was struggling to come up with a way to talk about the unique anti-Black racist misogyny that Black women experience and that people read as Black women experience. And I started to think about this because I was working with some documents from the 1910s from the segregated South, looking at medical school curriculum, both the textbooks that are created and some of the yearbooks that students use to document their time in medical school. And I was finding these caricatures of Black women in these spaces, which seemed interesting to me, given that this was during a time of segregation in the South. So it wasn't too surprising that the images were these, you know, derisive, negative caricatures of Black women. But what was interesting to me is that they showed up in medical text and that they also mirrored things that I was seeing in popular culture contemporarily. And so I was trying to figure out, why haven't these images changed in the almost, you know, 100 years since the time of these yearbooks and textbooks to what is happening in 2008 with representations of Black women that are circulating in digital and other media spaces. So finding some language to talk about that was what led me to misogynoir as a term, and then got me thinking too about how representations actually materially impact Black women's health and their ability to navigate society more generally.
Though you coined this term back in 2008, I think it's probably fair to say there are some people who still haven't heard of it. What does that look like in the everyday for Black women and gender variant folks?
Even though I coined it in 2008, I don't think it really took off or got a lot of attention until I started talking about it more publicly. And I was part of a blogging collective called the Crunk Feminist Collective. And people started to use the term on that blog. And then I think Trudy was really instrumental in getting it to spread virally in different digital media spaces. And unfortunately, you know, the use of the term has really proliferated because there are so many examples of misogynoir in our contemporary society. One of the more recent examples that I give to make it very clear what misogynoir looks like is what happened with Meghan Markle earlier this year. Meghan Markle did a sit-down interview with Oprah and Prince Harry talking about the experiences she had with the royal family and the British press that ultimately made her feel like she wanted to take her own life. And the negative portrayals of Meghan and the disparate treatment between her and some of the other white princesses who have been connected to the British royal family really makes clear how misogynoir operates, that Meghan could feel like she needed to end her life to make the harassment stop, to me is a real example of how misogynoir gets operationalized. And some of the examples of misogynoir that she experienced are pretty notable, one of them being that before her first child was born, there was all this speculation within the royal family about what the color of the baby's skin might be. And then once the baby was born, the British press released a, comparison of the baby to a monkey. And we can think
Wow.
very specifically about how monkey, ape, gorilla imagery has been attached to Black people and Black women for a very long time.
Using Meghan Markle as an example, you say in your book, you talk about Black women being caught at a vexing crossroad, hyper visible in media through misogynoir, yet invisible when needing of life-saving attention. And that part really resonated with me, especially as a Black person living in a city with a long history of violent racism, how we can be completely unseen yet constantly policed. Meghan Markle felt the need to get away from media, but also at the same time had to go to media in a way to try to defend her existence, and still got pushed back for that. So thinking about that, what role can social media play in contributing to the misogynoir or combating it? I guess that's kind of the crux of your whole book.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I mean, one thing I will say is that I wrote a long form piece specifically thinking about Meghan Markle, mostly for the reasons that you're talking about. She is very privileged in terms of her social class and also her skin color. Even this question of, what color might the baby's skin be seems really ridiculous when she is so light-skinned, but that is how deeply seated misogynoir is, that even someone with all of her privileges, she can still experience this thing. And of course, that then begs the question, what is the reality for people who don't have her particular privileges in terms of social class status, in terms of skin color, etc.? So my book is definitely trying to get people to think about the people who are at the margins of the margins, people who have a lot less privilege than Meghan Markle. And then what is the story that they're telling? What is their experience of misogynoir in their own lives? How does misogynoir manifest when you don't have these particular privileges to rely on, fall back on? And in the book, I talk a lot about what the consequences are for regular Black women who are trying to negotiate the way misogynoir impacts their life. And I wanted to talk about that to some degree, but also point us in a direction that doesn't just linger in all of these examples of misogynoir. I wanted to show how Black women and other people who are read as Black women are resisting those negative stereotypes through the creation, the digital alchemy that allows them to create the digital spaces that they need to combat misogynoir and to create the world that they want to see. So I use some examples of different platforms. So I talk about the way that hashtags have been used to create community and networks among Black women. I've also talked about YouTube as a site for creating queer web shows that talk and extend the idea of what relationships can look like beyond what we're getting in mainstream media. And then I talk about the self-curation practices of non-binary femme Black folks on sites like Tumblr and the things that they create for themselves, the things that they want to see that definitely don't invoke misogynoir, very much the antithesis of misogynoir in terms of what it is that gives them hope, strength, and allows them to resist some of these very degrading depictions that circulate in popular culture.
In the book Massage Noir Transformed: Black Women's Digital Resistance, you talk about Tumblr and the early days of Twitter, and you kind of talk about them a little bit in the past tense, recognizing that while they might not be transformative in and of themselves, that they allowed a space for conversations and connections that needed to deal with oppressive forces. Do you feel that's still happening in these spaces where you've got platforms that are able to block hashtags, Black women's voices are being silenced, Black liberation organizations are finding their sites shut down. Do you feel like that's still happening in the digital world?
That's such a great question, and something that I've been grappling with as I've been, dealing with the time between writing the book and the way that the world exists now, is that social media has such a specific half-life. Things change so quickly. And the book that I wrote in some ways doesn't apply to the digital media infrastructure that exists contemporarily. Just thinking about some of my early days on Twitter and Tumblr, there was a different way that people approached each other in terms of their interaction with folks' social media. Even this language of followers feels relatively new, because even though people might follow a blog, there was definitely a sense that you were engaging with another person that you were getting to know. You read their blog, they read your blog. It was much more of an exchange among people who understood themselves as peers, as opposed to people who, I think in this contemporary moment, understand themselves as a brand and as people who are attracting a group of people who will follow what they're saying, but aren't necessarily interacting with each of those people on an equal level. So I think that the platforms themselves have changed the way that people engage with social media and the types of conversations that were possible just a few years ago are not possible in this contemporary moment.
Thinking about that, it really feels like the transformation that you're talking about is decidedly anti-capitalist. I just don't see how it could fit within, because what you're talking about with the brands and consumers, that's exactly it. I think it was Sonia Renee Taylor on Instagram, ironically, was talking about how we've traded conversations for platforms as she was talking about why she was leaving Instagram. But it's like, it's this tool that people use, but it doesn't feel like the same kind of connection that you were talking about as being part of the resistance. What is the future of that real connection?
Yeah, I really think that we're going to have a mix of platforms. And also, I'm really interested in us designing what we want as opposed to relying on whatever technology that corporations think that we need or sell to us or use to sell us to other corporations. Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. I do not see the world we want as coexisting within capitalism. I do think that ultimately what we need is the end of capitalism. Does that mean the end of the internet as we know it? I think it probably does. I do think it means that the digital platforms we design will be very different, because the goal will have to be different. And the idea of using these tools as a method of exchange and connection has really changed because of the types of infiltration of corporate interests into these platforms, and also even before we get the platform, very much baked into the design of the platforms themselves. So in one of the last chapters of the book, I ask some of the people who I have felt were really instrumental in my own growth and development and thinking about these issues, what would help them, what would they look for in an ideal social media platform? And one of the things that came up in the responses was the idea that whatever is created is iterative and that it can change and adapt to the needs of the group of people it's serving. And of course, that's definitely not the model that we see with digital platforms currently. Terms of service change without any seeming response or interest in what people using the platform might think. This was something that was happening with Tumblr all the time, that there were changes to the design and structure of the platform over and over again, to the point where, people just abandoned it because it was no longer serving the communities that really found it so helpful and made it popular, a popular space for people who had the kinds of ideas that were flowing back and forth between each other. It really collapsed the platform as a primary space of communication that was not one-sided. And I do think that we have to look to a future where the people who are using the platform are more integral in the design. And that is not where we are at this current moment.
I thought there was a, and maybe I'm wrong about this, was Clubhouse black or designed by black folks, or was it just where people were going for a minute?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. I also missed out on the Clubhouse moment because initially it was only for iPhones. And so if you didn't have an iPhone, you couldn't participate. I know that's changed recently, but of course, Clubhouse has declined as the world has opened up again. But even in thinking about who people want to interact with or how people are using these different platforms, it does beg the question too about what do users have to say and who gets to participate in the conversation if it's only being had on one particular platform and not everyone can access it. So I do think that this raises other questions about how do people get the seed money? How do people get the resources to create the platforms that they need and to create the platforms that serve the greatest number of people within a population and don't just allow people to interact in a very unidirectional way, that there's opportunities for people to process information and speak to one another. Not from a top-down hierarchical way of understanding that there's opportunities for multiple conversations in multiple directions.
The digital resistance that you want to talk about, and I really want to talk about some of the change and the alchemy that you refer to in the book. You spend a lot of time talking about why the digital resistance is undoubtedly and unapologetically black and queer. Why was it so important to specifically center trans liberation in your book?
Yeah, so one of the things that happens, I think, a little bit too often is that the term black woman gets assumed to be cis and heterosexual. When people say black women, I think that's who they imagine. And when I think about who the people were who were instrumental in the digital resistance that I was seeing, it was really queer women, trans women, and non-binary, gender variant, agender folks who were doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And I think that's because people at the margins of Black womanhood or the idea of Black woman, trademarked, capital B, capital W, find ourselves in this space where there's so much that's being evoked with this term that doesn't necessarily apply to our existence. And our resistance to this very narrow representation of who Black women are actually opens up and explodes the possibilities for the category for other people who might more readily be assumed to be at the center of that category. So for me, it's important that Black trans women are centered and that Black queer and other gender expansive members of the community who experience misogynoir are centered, because they are usually the ones who are experiencing some of the worst violence, some of the worst consequences for people's limited imaginations, and have the most to gain by having this particular construct upended and challenged. So I have seen that in my own research, that it's the people who are at the margins who are doing the most work. And relatedly, I draw a lot on the Combahee River Collective statement. And there's a moment in the statement where they say, you know, if Black women were free, it would necessitate the end of all systems of oppression. And for me, that is such an important framing that informs all of the work that I do, and putting the most marginal of Black women at the center of our freedom gives us the opportunity to create a freedom that actually ripples out and affects everyone.
It sounds so wonderful when you put it that way, and it makes so much sense. One of the things that I thought was interesting when I was reading your bio, it says that you are the digital alchemist for the Octavia Butler Legacy Network. What does that mean exactly, and how does that relate to the work that you're doing in your book?
Yeah, digital alchemy was something that I came up with to talk about how I see Black women and other women of color taking the digital tools that are available to them and transforming them into something that's greater than their parts. So if we think about alchemy, it's this pseudoscience of turning regular metals into gold. And I see the work that Black women are doing with platforms like Twitter, Tumblr, YouTube, these tools that were really designed to extract resources, extract information and data from users. They've transformed them into these wonderful social justice tools that have enabled new networks of community to form, new ideas about what our communities actually look like, what it is that we're striving for and are interested in. So that act of transformation is what I call digital alchemy. So in the Octavia E. Butler Legacy Network, I see my role as taking some of the social media that is normally being used to just amplify certain narratives, to try and think more creatively about how we can use these digital tools to uplift the legacy of Octavia Butler. So one of the ways that I tried to do that was through a hashtag, Octavia Taught Me. And that is a hashtag that we invoke yearly around her birthday or around her transition to being an ancestor, to talk about all of the things that Octavia Butler has taught us through her life and writing, how Octavia Butler's work really opens up and expands how we're able to see our world. And I know this is airing a bit later, but it's rather auspicious that we're talking on Octavia Butler's birthday.
That's perfect. Thinking back to something you said a couple minutes ago about the layers of oppression, I kind of wanted to ask a question of what you think about the fat suit. You talk in the book about the long history of male actors like Tyler Perry, Eddie Murphy, and other famous Black cis men who have donned the fat suit to play their, what I have to believe, insulting versions of Black women. Do you think the fat suit is inherently an extension of misogynoir? Can the parallel be made for the man in a dress trope when you have cis men play trans women in movies? What do you think about that whole thing?
I think that fat suits generally are used for comedic purposes, I do think that generally, though, fat suits should not be used. To me, they're very similar to blackface and ideas of trying to put on or make someone appear in a way that doesn't match who they actually are. I'm thinking also about Zoe Saldana's portrayal of Nina Simone and the darkening of her skin and the prosthetic nose she was given, whereas there are a slew of other black actors who could have portrayed that character, could have portrayed Nina Simone in a more effective way. So I think it's also beholden on the actor to make different decisions. And, you know, we heard about this with Amanda Sandberg, you know, declining to take a role as Shuri and Black Panther, understanding and really taking into consideration what it would mean for a darker skin actor to portray Shuri in that film. I do think actors are making those decisions about the role.
Where can people find you online? What places are you making those connections and building community?
That's such an interesting question. You know, one of the things I say in the book is that I didn't want to write about Tumblr because I felt like it was my last little respite safe haven on the internet where I felt people were still open to having conversations, but Tumblr has essentially become defunct given the changes in its administration and changes in terms of service. It's a desolate wasteland. And so that used to be one place where I would find myself and find the kinds of connections that I was looking for, but it's really changed. But if you just want to like get in touch with me, I'm on Twitter as at MoyaZB. I also have a blog and website, moyabailey.com. Those are the easiest ways to find me. But I don't see anything that has really replicated or come close to those early days of Blogger, of LiveJournal, when people were able to communicate and talk to one another more freely and openly than they're able to do at this current moment.
Maybe I'm showing my age, but LiveJournal was the last time I really was engaged.
It's a different platform. The platform makes such a difference in terms of how people are able to use and connect with one another.
The book is Massage Noir Transformed: Black Women's Digital Resistance. Dr. Moyo Bailey, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your questions.